Hello, and welcome to Essential Work, exploring the past, present, and future of jobs. This podcast brought to you by the Battle of Homestead Foundation. I'm Nathan Ruggles. Thank you for listening. Each week, we bring you stories and struggles, people and perspectives, interviews and commentaries, all on the world of work yesterday, today, and tomorrow. We look at the most important issues people face on the job through a unique lens of history and time and music. If you're a history buff, if you're curious about what the workplace of the future will look like, if you face your own challenges on the job, if you appreciate context that helps you better understand our particular moment in time, if you enjoy how music can provide an artistic window into issues, this is the podcast for you. Here in our 10th episode, Larry McCullough joins us, as always, with the latest from our sponsor, the Battle of Homestead Foundation, based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and closes us out with his song selection inspired by our feature interview. But first, that feature is once again led by host Patty DeMarco with Pathways to a New Economy That Works for All of Us. With her 30-year career in energy and environmental policy in both the private and public sector, Patty addresses labor, environment, and health considerations as she explores reimagining America with her guests, all amazing experts and change agents who are building those positive pathways toward a sustainable future.
This is Patricia DeMarco. This is my program every month called Pathways to a New Economy That Works for All of Us. And my guest today is Tom Croft. He is the executive director of the Steel Valley Authority and also the managing director of the Heartland Network for Sustainable Investment. And we've been talking about the fact that we're in a really significant transformation of our economy to a more renewable and sustainable base. And Tom Croft is one of these wonderful people who's been working on this transition for a long, long time. And Tom, I welcome you to our program, and I'd love to have you explain a little bit about how you got into being involved with Steel Valley Authority and what the significance of this work is right now.
Thank you, Patty. Thanks for having me on the show. Really appreciate it, and I've admired your work for many years as well. So I started my tenure at the Steel Valley Authority, the SVA, in 1988. I'd been working on the West Coast for 10, 15 years on political issues and also on economic transition, starting in the Pacific Northwest and the Redwoods, where we had a massive downturn in the economy at the end of the 70s, early 80s. In the entire Pacific Northwest, the lumber industry, the mining industry, and the fishing industry. But we helped to win a program that saved about 6,000 workers' income after the Redwood National Park was expanded. And that program was called the Redwood Employee Protection Program, and it provided $100 million for 6,000 workers for up to 6 years. Mm. So it's the best just transition program in the country, as far as I knew. I was in Seattle for several years after that, set up the Seattle Worker Center, and worked on the shipyards industry collapse of the mid-80s. And that program, the Worker Center, went on to do a lot of great things for another 20 years, 25 years or so. Came to Pittsburgh in 1988. I'd met Mike Stout, Charlie McAllister, Jay Weinberg, a lot of the folks from the steelworkers over those interlapping years. And my family has been in the South, and so I wanted to get a little closer to this coast. And so the authority was set up to initially address the collapse of the steel industry in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And as we went on, we also tried to set up programs to help smaller manufacturers that were in the region. Mayor Sophie Maslow provided her first seed funding. Mm-hmm. And then the state, we caught the attention of the state, and the state essentially came to us and asked us to manage the program on a larger basis, on a longer term basis, on a wider area, wider geographical area. So we expanded it to 10 counties and then 20, and then over 5 or 6 governors, we've opened 5 offices across the state. We've worked now with 1,300 manufacturers. we have saved the jobs or averted those losses or deferred those job losses of around 31,000-32,000 workers over that period of time. So that's how the Steel Valley Authority began getting involved in economic transition and all those things.
And it's really an important thing to recognize that at this point in time, a lot of what has traditionally been the backbone of our economy is based on fossil extractive industries that we need to transition or transform away from in order to have our climate and our environment survive, which is what supports all of us. And doing that in a way that preserves the viability of communities, the viability of workers, will require not just reinvestment, but also rethinking the nature of work and how we actually provide the resources that we need for daily life. So I'm really excited to see that your authority, which has been focused on maintaining jobs in those industries, can now help in building investments in communities that will grow the economy in ways that can be sustained and be more resilient. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the initiative that you were involved with at the University of Pittsburgh with the mayors of Ohio, Kentucky, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia to look at a Marshall Plan for Middle America, which is really in running in parallel with the Reimagine Appalachia blueprint that we've been working on from the non-government and organizational side. And I really think this is a very important thing to do, is to look at this as a way to rethink the assets that we have in this region, not only the workforce, but also the capability and skill of all those people now shifting to build a new way of working, a new way of powering our economy. So I'd like if you share a little bit about what's the nature of this transition that's a little different than some of the ones we've been through in the past.
Right. As we look at what's happened the last three decades or so, there was obviously the economy in this region obviously suffered through a lot of boom-bust economy trends, and we also suffered greatly from bad trade deals like NAFTA and the WTO. And so our work in the field, we've worked through several recessions and downturns. You know, I want to just clearly state that the authority, in terms of our program that's funded to help manufacturing companies stay in business, that's funded through the Pennsylvania Department of Labor and Industry. And we actually work with 40 to 80 companies, sometimes 100 companies a year. We assist every company that comes to us. It doesn't matter where they come from. If they can be in the fossil industry sector, we have been seeing a lot of firms in that sector sort of have trouble over the last year or so, even before the shutdowns caused by COVID. But, you know, years ago, we began working with the steelworkers on trying to find additional capital for companies in trouble. And the steelworkers had been very smart about that strategy. And it actually on a kind of on a corporate restructuring level, working with national and global corporations, they began working with investment banks, people like Lazard Frere out of New York City, and sympathetic bankers who assisted the steelworkers and some of their leadership in negotiating with companies to make sure that in that negotiation during those several decades of economic turmoil and shutdowns, that the steelworkers could get the best deal possible working with corporations to save as many jobs as possible and to restructure in a humane way. So as part of that, I worked with Leo Gerard to set up the Heartland Capital Network, the Labor Capital Network. And we began looking at how do we move America's pension funds to invest in ways that will help to rebuild our economy. And so we had actually had great models from the building trades, the construction trades, which had been working since the 1960s to establish construction trusts. And then those trusts were investing pension dollars in affordable housing projects and other real estate projects. And all of that started actually after a meeting between Dr. Martin Luther King and George Meany, who was the president of the AFL-CIO back in the day. Yeah. Back in 1960. So fast forward from 1960 to 1995 or so, and we were working on a company that in northern western Pennsylvania in the Franklin area, the Oil City area, where the insiders had essentially embezzled the company And the company was going to close, and the union, the steelworkers union, blocked the gates and kept the company intact over the winter, prevented the banks from dismantling the equipment. We eventually found a buyer for that, but through that process, Leo Gerard and I asked the question, where is our money?
Yeah.
And we began to pull together a group of folks from around the country, from different unions, from academia, from business, from labor. And that became the Heartland Labor Capital Network. And through that process, we've put together several conferences, several roadshows across America. And we now just completed a couple of years ago, published our fourth book on how do we reinvest workers' capital to rebuild our cities, to innovate the industrial commons, and to grow the clean economy.
And I think the growing the clean economy is so important because in other parts of the world, like in Europe, there have been deliberate policies to invest toward the net zero by 2050 goal.
Right.
And our country is far behind that.
Right.
And it's always been cast as it's trying to preserve the jobs that we have and save coal and save all of these things that we need. We know we need to move away from, and we need to do it in a way that's just and equitable, and that we can use this opportunity to solve some of the entrenched inequities that have occurred in our system. The burden has not fallen evenly on everybody. We have severe disparities in the ability to acquire wealth. The top 1% is just fine. They've had a 237% increase in wealth over the period from 1986 until now. And the middle 60%, the people who do the work, who are working full time, sometimes holding down more than one job, they've only had a 47% increase in wealth acquisition over that same period. And that gap is getting bigger and bigger all the time. Those of us who work our heads off all the time are not the ones who are benefiting from all this labor. And I think that balance of the Wall Street and the environment and the culture and social equity in our community needs to be reestablished, because right now it's way out of balance. And I think what you've been talking about in this new Marshall Plan, it's really important to recognize that it has goals showing that women and people of color, immigrants, workers without college educations, lower income people are more likely than members of other groups to suffer job disruptions and financial hardship, not only because of the pandemic that we're experiencing, but also as the transition goes forward. So we need to do deliberate policies that address these inequities,
right,
in order to have the economy work for all of us. And I think that, to me, is one of the biggest lessons from this last election, is that a lot of people in this country don't feel the system we have is working for them. And we need to face that head on and identify the root causes of these inequities and begin investing in things that actually begin to level the playing field and make our society more resilient and more equitable. I was very excited to read this Marshall Plan because it begins to address some of these problems overtly and not just say, well, it'll happen if it all trickles down, because it doesn't trickle down.
You know, when I was approached initially about the work with the folks from the Reimagine Appalachia group and to play out whether or not we could stand up at a sort of a capital roundtable, as we called our pilot project about a year ago in Pittsburgh, where we brought investors to town and we also listened to developers in the region who were doing amazing things but needed capital. Mm-hmm. That model was something that appealed to folks. And then also I also received a call from the mayor's office regarding the possibility of working with the mayor's office on this Marshall Plan idea. And I basically tried to use the Sustainable Finance Hub convening as a way to bring both parties together. And I think that worked fairly well. But the general idea is that for the last 10 to 15 years, we've obviously had developments in this region, which were, you know, looking to things like fracking as a possible new economic boom. We certainly worked in the Steel Valley Authority with companies in the manufacturing arena who were connected to that sector of the economy. But it became clear in the last year or so that economic sector was having some major problems, and half the industry appeared to be moving into bankruptcy. That's before the shutdown of the economy due to COVID. So we also were concerned about how do we replace some of the lost energy sector that we're losing. And so I think that Mayor Perdido's idea was essentially that while the cities are drivers for this whole new clean energy revolution and have been working for the last decade or so, or sometimes 5-6 years across the country and across the world to come out to plan climate action plans. And many of them are now beginning to adopt and implement those plans mm-hmm. after many years of study. Mm-hmm. Bill's idea was that while the urban areas were important in terms of driving that agenda, that the city could not abandon their rural neighbors mm-hmm. and the mill towns, the coal communities that also were part of the original industrial commons of this region over the last century. So his idea was that while the cities might want to put together solar farms or wind projects, the cities don't have the room to put those within the city limits. And so Bill's idea was to place those facilities in rural communities mm-hmm. in places that have been left behind, and to make sure that some of those workers who have lost their jobs in the old economy are able to be brought, transitioned into these real jobs. And I'll just say one other thing. I think the environmental community has sort of made some assumptions that this green jobs revolution that we've been hearing about for the last 2 decades or so will somehow or another miraculously take place, and that people who lose their jobs will find a way to become part of that new revolution. I think the evidence is pretty clear that that did not happen. Unless there are specific public policies and corporate partnerships and labor partnerships to drive a real, utility scale initiatives and industrial scale initiatives, workers aren't going to just simply want to walk away from the job they have. And I can't blame them. They're trying to support their families. So Bill Peduto's idea and the other mayors in the region, especially in Cincinnati, for instance, where they're just establishing a 400 megawatt solar farm, the largest municipal mm-hmm. solar project in the country, which is also being placed in a rural community, I think that's the way to go. And also, they're working with the IBEW, with the union, so those are good union jobs. And there's also, through that project labor agreement, the PLA, there's also a pipeline for minority workers and other workers to be brought in as apprentices as part of that work. So that's really a model, I think, has some legs, and I think labor can get excited about that model.
I agree, and I think you're right to say that without public policies that drive this transition, it isn't going to happen because the market will not drive this.
Right.
The market is backward looking. The market is not a policy driven, forward looking agent of change. And I think in cases where you do have public investment or public funds and public policy supportive, then the change happens and you do get investment in workers, you get empowerment of workers, you get empowerment of communities because they have new opportunities in a new sustainable world. And I think we need to recognize that without policies like supporting the regional greenhouse gas initiatives, supporting requirements for use of renewable energy in, I've been working on the climate action plan for my community, and we're a community of 5,000 people. Mm-hmm. We can only go so far without supportive policies at the state and federal level. But think about how different it would be if you have a national building code that says all new buildings and major renovations have to use passive solar design and geothermal earth tubes.
Right.
You would have a shift in the labor in the construction industry to migrate to those tools. It is not a different set of skills. It's the same skills.
Right.
It's just oriented to a different market that doesn't exist in the, the marketplace isn't going to drive that direction fast enough to make a difference.
Right.
So I think it isn't that people need to get out of the energy industry. They need to redefine what the energy industry is.
Yeah.
And it isn't a fuel substitution issue. It's a system change, because the fuel system that we have now for generating power is a technology that was invented in 1865. Mm-hmm. And when you burn anything, whether it's, uranium based or coal or gas or oil, you turn a turbine to make steam to make electricity, you have only one third of that fuel value going to the electricity. The rest of it goes up the chimney.
Yep.
And if you add pollution controls, sometimes you get down as low, like at the Cheswick Power Plant, it gets down as low as 11% of the fuel value actually goes into the wire.
That's interesting.
Because you have to put on a scrubber, you have to put on a mercury containment, you have to put on a precipitate. I mean, by the time you do all of that, the energy that you've spent is, it's a diminishing return.
Sure.
So their answer is, oh, good, we have to burn more coal. This is great. That isn't the right solution, right? So what we need to do is really get behind these things that say buildings can also generate energy as well as use energy.
Right.
Our passive solar design borough building has now been 26 months on a net zero basis.
Wow.
We had a credit left in March after the end of using our credit from the prior summer all winter.
That's good. That's great.
We ended up with a net zero design building. We did not have any outlandish technology used in that building. It had a lot of really exciting passive solar design features. And we have drillers who came to the site to drill the geothermal earth tubes and had wonderful adventures when we found out that the coal mine that nobody knew was there was 95 feet under the building.
Wow.
We had to redesign the whole geothermal field in order to avoid hitting the coal mine. Of course, the engineers told me, oh, we just put a sleeve around that. We could go right through it. I said, nobody's putting any sleeves in any coal mine. You know, don't, just don't even go there. Because
right,
if you punch a hole in the thing, who knows what's going to happen, right?
Sure, right.
So
right.
We had to redesign our geothermal field. And everybody thought that would kill the project because of the cost. But it turns out the biggest expense was bringing the drill to the site.
Got it.
And once you've got it there, whether you punch 12 holes or 39, it really doesn't make that much difference. So
yeah,
we were able to do that. And so those people are the same people that drill. They can do geothermal tube wells just as well as they do fracking wells. It's the same technology. You
right.
drill down and you put pipe in and you bend it and you shape it under things and
yep.
you put fluids through it. And you know, you get HVAC systems instead of fracking plants. And it's the same workers, okay? It's the same employed people.
Yeah.
And I think the opportunities in not just the energy field, but also in creating materials and a circular materials management opportunity. Every day I'm finding out more and more about technologies that are used in other places that are looking to come here for not just recapturing the plastics that we already have, but also making things. I mean, I came across a person the other day. It's a company that they make plastics out of mushrooms.
Right.
Fungi, and they're biodegradable. And so for single-use materials like plastic bags or packaging, they can be made out of material that degrades in 5 to 10 years in a landfill instead of 400 to 200 to never.
Right.
So there are people who are looking at these bio-based materials and also at circular material management so that you can make industrial parks, eco-industrial parks, they're calling them, out of turning our economy from one that goes from raw material to trash
right.
to an economy that goes in a circular manner that recovers and reclaims and reuses materials. That is a manufacturing base that can be sustained
right.
without the environmental impact and without the devastation of the land.
Good point.
Yeah. So I look at this Marshall Plan and this opportunity, because all of these things need investment. You know, you need a factory site. You can reclaim factory sites that exist. And I know there's a group up at Penn State that's looking at taking a former coal plant and turning it into an eco-industrial park. And I think that's the kind of thing we need to do, is look at what do we have in the way of infrastructure and what do we have in the way of skill labor. And how can we combine those with a new direction? And it needs investment. It absolutely needs investment. And the government alone isn't going to be able to do it. But the policies that drive in that direction, I think, will begin to attract capital opportunities that then can help to build the economy in a new direction.
Right. So I think that the basic outline that Bill sort of presented was that the cities could amalgamate and aggregate procurement for
yep.
for things like wind farms, solar farms, hydro water projects, but also things like electric buses.
Yep.
things like district energy, broadband, and then the cities could also work with their pension funds to adopt responsible investment policies. And those pension funds, there's another sort of angle on that, which is that pension funds can adopt what are called economically targeted investment strategies, or ETIs, which have been essentially legalized in the United States since 1994. And the Department of Labor, which essentially first promulgated the ETI rule of 1994. So unfortunately, the Republicans have come along and tried to banish that rule, or ban it, or reverse it. And that happened again this summer when the Trump administration tried to essentially reverse that rule, so that it made it more difficult for investors to invest responsibly. But the problem for Trump and for the Koch brothers, who were involved, I guess, in that, in the background there, was that the market itself has moved globally toward responsible investment. And if you follow groups like the Sustainable Investment Forum or the Social Investment Forum, they just released another report on how much capital is now being invested with responsible investment mandates or corporate governance frameworks in mind. And essentially, I believe that they came out with a number of something like $17 trillion in the United States. So pension funds and asset managers, university endowments, many of those are sort of moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. And then we've been working through the Heartland Network with investors who have been managing pension funds in real estate, in private capital, and also in the sort of new category called community scale infrastructure, which turns out to be primarily renewable and clean economy projects. So at the convening a few weeks ago, we actually had some of those investors and project partners to talk about things like the solar project in Cincinnati, a teacher's village in McDowell County, the poorest county in West Virginia, infrastructure fund that's invested in over a dozen transactions. And the example, which I thought was really kind of pertinent to this region, was another Heartland partner who invested in a oil refinery in Bakersfield, California, and converted that to a renewable fuels refinery. So there's a lot of those kinds of projects that are now getting up and running. Many of those are in this region. I think people were sort of surprised to see how many interesting things are happening in the region. And so now what we need is to sort of think about what's the federal ask. We're lining up investments in this region. We're pushing the pension funds, as we did with the City of Pittsburgh Pension Fund, to adopt responsible investment mandates. What is the federal ask? How can we get the federal government to now support this initiative, as opposed to coming in with its own ideas about how they would like to see a top-down strategy play out? We don't need their top-down strategy.
Thank you.
We need a bottoms-up strategy that essentially pushes the government to become a partner, not a game maker.
Thank you very much for that. I think that's what we've been saying all along, is that people in this region, people in the rural regions, know what we want to do to go forward. And I've spent a lot of time listening to people from the Appalachia region, from West Virginia and Ohio, and we've done Reimagine projects. I think the League of Women Voters started those in 2017 or so. Mm-hmm. I've been involved with six of them all around the state, nice. Down as far as Wheeling and over to Ohio. And I think what people are saying is that we really want to have an economy that works for all of us. We don't want an economy that somebody decides about down in Washington and tells us what to do. And a lot of the experience of the Appalachia region that's different and requires a separate blueprint that we've been working on, as you see, is that we've had the wealth of this region extracted and it goes away. It doesn't come back and enrich the communities from which it is taken. And the taxpayers and the residents of these areas are left with the costs. They're left with the cleanup. They're left with damaged health. And these people are very talented, skilled, resilient, wonderful people, and they have good ideas about what they'd rather do with their land and what they'd rather do with their time and their energy. And this kind of investment strategy where the government policies set the guidelines and then we have the opportunity to put money into these places that will actually enrich and create actual wealth in these communities all across Middle America. I think that's the exciting part of this new Marshall Plan and the Reimagine Appalachia Blueprint. And the work that you're doing on driving investment into communities, I think is really, really critical and important. And it's going to be wonderful to see how this plays out. I feel more hopeful about our future than I ever have.
Good.
The last 10 or 20 years.
Yeah.
I had the experience of the Woodland Hills High School students did a climate summit. Hmm. They had 263 students from all around the area attend. And it was all about empowering youth to think positive things about their future. They are not kept down. And I think it's our responsibility to see to it that we preserve our planet in a way that can sustain life. And that will persist for generations forward. So this is not an abandonment of the people who built the wealth of our country on the coal mines and the steel mills.
Right.
It's a matter of shifting their skill and capability and wonderful capacity for innovation into a direction that can be sustained and that will enrich all of us. So I thank you so much for joining us today. Is there anywhere people can go to find out more about your work that you'd like to tell them how to reach you?
Yeah, sure. So www.heartlandnetwork is one word, heartlandnetwork.org is the investment side of our Steel Valley Authority's work. The SVA is www.steelvalley.org, and you'll see more of our work around revitalizing companies, working through this COVID crisis with manufacturers around the state, trying to help them through that process. In the Heartland Network, we're just announcing in the last couple of weeks another national policy initiative, which is Congressman Andy Levin's Sustainable Investment Policy Act, which is being introduced, I believe, as we speak. And essentially that will then, is similar to the way we need, you know, our federal government to be a partner, we need our pension funds to stop investing in ways that are harmful to our economy and to our environment and to workers. And so that the Investment Act will require pension funds and investment asset managers to consider environmental, social, and governance concerns when they make their investments. So we know that there's an uphill battle, but I think all of us are ready for the battle in terms of getting that passed and also reversing the Department of Labor rule this past summer that the Trump administration put together that actually tied investors' hands so that it is more difficult to invest responsibly. The reality is that the market and the global capital markets have left the Trump administration and the Koch brothers behind. There's no way they can stop the movement toward responsible investment. But we can put some guardrails back up and make sure that there's not artificial bureaucratic rules that screw with the people who own the money. It's the workers who own that capital. And globally, those workers own $40 trillion of pension capital. So
the green economy will really be fun. There is money available to fund this. It isn't going to need to be all taxpayers' money. It's how we choose to invest our money and how we choose to set our priorities. And
right.
I hope that, you know, having dialogues like this will help reach people who feel like they've been left out of the way and don't have a way forward in the new economy, because I think the way forward really is a lot more inclusive and does offer more ways for wealth to expand into all parts of our economy and cover people who haven't had a chance to participate before.
Good point.
Well, thank you so much. I hope you have a wonderful day and a wonderful weekend. And thank you for joining us on Pathways to a New Economy.
Thank you so much. I look forward to listening.
Talk to you soon. Thanks. Bye-bye.
And this is Nathan Ruggles back with you here to finish up this episode of Essential Work, which requires none other than Battle of Homestead Foundation Communications Manager and Podcast Music Master, Larry McCullough. Larry, thanks for being here on the podcast.
Well, thanks a lot, Nathan. Great to be here.
Now, Larry always takes inspiration from our feature interview for his music choices. And of course, we just had that excellent interview there with Dr. Patty DeMarco and Tom Croft. But first, before we get to that, we need to hear the latest from the Battle of Homestead Foundation. So, Larry, what can you tell us? What's going on?
Well, right now we're in the program planning for 2021. We had 6 great programs last year, and now we're going to get 6 great programs for 2021. So if anyone has a suggestion of a speaker they might like to hear, maybe in person, but certainly online, or a topic that they would like us to find a speaker for or a panel, they should just tell us, because the program committee is meeting right now. And just email your suggestions to bhfprograms@gmail.com. Because that's how we got programs last year, is people just said, hey, I've got an idea, I've got a topic, I've got a book. So that's really how it works.
That's right.
It is totally grassroots, ground up. People told us about them.
Absolutely. And some fantastic events on Zoom as Battle Homestead Foundation moved all its programming online. The program committee is not sure, as all of us aren't sure what's to come in 2021, right? But the Battle Homestead Foundation is prepared to stay in line with the programs, or if things open up and we get out of this pandemic, we might have some live events again. So, yeah.
Yeah, or the live events could also be Zoomed. So that way,
absolutely,
because a lot of people, as are listening to this podcast, don't actually live within driving distance of the site or the venue. So maybe we'll combine the best of both worlds.
Absolutely. And for those who might have missed any of those 6 programs from last year, the organization is working on getting those up on YouTube. And in fact, Larry, we should mention that one of them just went up, right?
Right. The October 14th program with Mike Stout, talking about his book, Homestead Steel Mill, The Final 10 Years. That video is up on the Battle of Homestead channel on YouTube. Go in and check it out.
And we should mention, Larry, that you interviewed him, right?
Right.
about his book, right?
Yeah, so, it's a great book.
So you can see Larry there. You can hear Mike Stout on that if you missed it the first time, or if you'd like to hear that again, that is up on YouTube, and look for more of the same coming up. But that's not the only thing that's going on YouTube on a regular basis.
Right. We've got Charlie's Monday Markers, episode 22, is about the 1938 convention of the CIO, the very first major national CIO convention, happened in Pittsburgh at the Islam Grotto over on the north side. And Charlie McAllister talks about that and the significance that that had with the labor movement.
That's right. That's right. And the CIO, of course, Congress of Industrial Organizations, one of the two organizations, the two unions that came together to form the present-day AFL-CIO, mm-hmm. right?
And the next programs are going to be Max Ovanka murals, the St. Nicholas murals in Millville, and the Kennedy-Nixon-Taft-Hartley debate that happened at the Penn McKee Hotel in McKeesport in 1947, and the United Mine Workers president, Jock Leblonsky, in 1969, his leadership and then his assassination. And all these have historic markers in various places to remind people of the events. But Charlie's Monday Marker actually goes into the detail and some of the historical and social context that makes it a lot more than just a little blue marker you see on the side of the road somewhere.
And you mentioned all these events. You mentioned all these markers in our area. Pittsburgh's such a rich history here of not just labor, but all kinds of events. And we are so fortunate to have Charlie McAllister available to delve deep into this history, and he makes that available each week. So if you haven't checked that out, head out to the YouTube channel for the Battle Homestead Foundation. You can go to battlehomestead.org, of course, and the link is there. Yeah, so we'll look forward to those future episodes. That's for certain. Of course, Larry, you take care of our Facebook page. And right. Certainly a great place for folks to check out the latest news and information from the organization. And also, you can sign up for our email list for the organization, for Battle Homestead Foundation, from the website as well. And speaking of emails, we also welcome your emails as well here for the podcast. If you have any suggestions for us, any responses, feedback on anything we're doing, We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at comments@essentialworkpodcast.org. Or if you'd like to give us a call, you can always give us a voicemail at 412-326-9435, 412-326-9435. So that email, that number, and all the links we talk about here are in the episode description. You can also find our prior episodes for the podcast, essentialworkpodcast.org. While you're at it, if you enjoyed this episode, if you like what you're hearing with the podcast, please go to Apple Podcasts. Give us a like there. Give us a 5-star review, please. Tell people what you think of the program. Tell a friend, share it online, share it on the social media. Let people know about us. It really helps us out quite a bit. Now, before we get on to Larry's song selection, just like to send some thanks out here. First of all, to the program committee that we talked about earlier. They provide a lot of support for this program. I'd like to thank them for their efforts. Also, giving some credit out to our sometime audio engineer who helps us out when we need it, Angela Bachman. You can find her at thatsoundgirl.com. Also, Brittany Sheets. She designed our logo, her website, bsheetscreative.com, and our original music theme composed and recorded by Jason Kendall. JasonKendallProductions.com is where you can find him. So Larry, tell us, what do you got for us here this week with your song selection?
Well, I'll tell you, Nathan, I don't know about you, but I am giving thanks for a lot of things, but mainly for the incredible treasure trove of musicians and songwriters and poets who have written about labor issues and worker rights for the last few centuries. And living in Pittsburgh in 2020 and soon to be 2021, we can be especially thankful for the early generations of labor songwriters in this area who inspired and documented the local labor movement from the ground up.
Certainly.
When I got to town here, first in the mid-1970s, it sort of seemed like the original folk music boom of the 60s had passed or changed into a lot of different other types of music. But in reality, it was still very active. You just had to know where to look for it. And I eventually discovered a generation of performers in Pittsburgh who had been singing folk music and labor songs from the 1940s into the 1960s, but then weren't doing it so publicly anymore.
So they had performed publicly in the past, but they just weren't seen so much at that time.
Exactly. And they had made records that had been pressed and gone out. They were contemporaries of Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, Lead Belly, The Weavers, all those, you know, great groups, that Almanac Singers in the 1940s and 50s.
Those legends from that era, right?
Exactly. And they took the really deep ethnic roots of Pittsburgh labor music and brought it to a larger audience. And I think it was their dedication that kept a lot of folk and labor music alive that likely would have disappeared and not been able to inspire today's performers. Jack Schmertz, Gretchen Jacob, Joe and Eero Davidson. And there was a woman named Vivian Richman who recorded in 1959 on Folkways Records, Aya Labor Man. And that is pretty much a direct translation of Slovak for I'm a working man, a labor
okay.
man.
Okay, very good.
And I think a lot of things got anglicized. When people came to this country, they started using the idioms they heard. And so you get a lot of different linguistic. And actually, the song is sung in Slovak and in English.
Well, that's not uncommon. You know, we talk about Spanglish, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So this song, she originally recorded it in 1959. It was reissued in 2004 by the Smithsonian, their record label. And it was composed sometime in the first decade of the 1900s. By a McKeesport steelworker named Andrew Cavalli. He had come over here right around 1900 and worked a number of years. And then in 1947, he sang it to Jacob Evanson, who was the Pittsburgh Public School superintendent of vocal music instruction.
Okay.
And a folk song collector who had worked with George Corson, who we've mentioned in an earlier podcast.
That's right.
Evanson went around the entire city, the area, getting as much indigenous music as he could, really. And it was eventually published in Corson's 1949 book, Pennsylvania Songs and Legends. So Cavalli actually told Evanson the following: "We who came from Slovakia sang much in those days, in saloons and in church and in the Sokol halls. We would make up songs of our own about our life in McKeesport and sing them to old Slovak folk song tunes we had known in the old country."
Oh, right. So he was, or Evanson was basically doing what Corson was doing elsewhere, and that's collecting songs like this.
Yep. And okay. So he met Andrew Cavalli in McKeesport and got some songs from him. And then Vivian Richman recorded this song that had been written in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. She recorded on her album, Vivian Richmond Sings Folk Songs of Western Pennsylvania. And that was on Folkways. It made the rounds. Like I say, that was just before the big folk boom. So probably didn't sell too many copies, but you know, it's today it's very important artifact to listen to. Then again, this song shows up 50 years later in 2009, about 100 years after it was originally composed. This time, and some of you may listening may have actually heard this, it was put into a four-movement classical composition by Albert Glinsky, who's a contemporary composer. The piece was called Allegheny Quartet. It was performed in 2009 at the New Hazlitt Theater on the North Side as part of the 200th anniversary of the city of Pittsburgh.
Wow, that is that song has taken quite a journey, hasn't it?
I'm sure when Andrew Cavalli and his buddies, you know, down McKeesport, probably in a kind of a party atmosphere, just made up this song, they had no idea that 100 years later it'd be performed as part of this city that they had really helped shape and form. Glinsky was commissioned by the Pittsburgh Chamber Music Society, and the Beava Quartet did the world premiere. Albert Glinsky incorporated a lot of ethnic music from our area into this celebratory commemorative piece.
Fantastic.
Yeah, Vivian Richmond died in 1990. She retired from Chatham College as chair of the education department and had throughout her adult life really been very active in the Pittsburgh peace movement. She organized sit-ins, teach-ins, benefit concerts, and she played at the National Folk Festival and was one of the chief organizers of the Pittsburgh Folk Festival for years.
So an educator as well as a singer, as well as a folk singer, as mm-hmm. well as involved in politics then.
Exactly. Now, we don't really know what the original composer of Vahi Labor Man really sounded like when he sang it a century ago, because there doesn't seem to be a recording, just a musical notation. But Vivian Richmond's version is really upbeat. It's a klezmer kind of sound, has bowed bass, clarinet, accordion, and Vivian, of course, on guitar and her very rich alto vocals.
Okay. All right. So we're going to have a bit of a sample here. And if folks are interested in this song, where do they find it?
Well, like so much great material has been reissued by Smithsonian Folkways Records. And you can find information on essentialworkpodcast.com. And again, I think that why I really enjoy finding songs like this is all the folk, incredible music that's happening today with labor and working songs. The roots are still there. And there was this whole generation of people like the Schmertzes and Vivian Richmond, who really were sort of the bridge that kept this music alive. They kept really strong links with the immigrant populations, to working people who were making these songs, and they saved a lot of them. So we can hear them today.
Excellent. Well, we'll make sure to have a link to that audio clip in the episode description then.
So I'm a Working Man by Andrew Cavalli. I'll read you just a few of the lyrics in English. I'm a working man. I work every day. Always I am dreaming, always I am counting, how many dollars am I saving? Next verse. When payday comes around the middle of the month, I throw a dollar on the bar, buy everybody, drink free, I'll have a drink on payday. And the final verse in English is, from the old country comes a letter. Right away I answer it, back to Slovakia. I can borrow $100, all for my wife when it is payday. So again, we're not really sure, you know, the circumstances of Mr. Cavalli composing this song, or even if these were his circumstances, or maybe just a general comment on immigrant workers at the time in steel
mills. Yeah, whether it was his own personal inspiration or he's inspired by something else, we're not sure.
But definitely he's talking, you know, concerned about how much money is he saving, because even though he likes to have a little fun with his pals at the tavern, there is the reality of the old country. He's got a family, and a lot of immigrants came, and they kept sending money back to people over there to keep them alive, basically. And then sometimes bring them over if it was possible. So this is, again, an interesting song that has a little bit of fancy, but also, I think, some serious reality.
Yeah, it really tells a story. And not just a story of Slovakia, and an American story as well.
And here is a audio clip of Aha Labor Man, recorded by Vivian Richmond.
Tym da co pozlal, senem za stoliček napiszem listoček pośle w ziemne skoku na pedu. I'm a working man, I work every day. Always I am dreaming, always I am counting how many dollars am I saving. When payday comes around the middle of the month, From all country comes a letter, right away I answer it. Back to Slovakia I send her $100 all for my wife when it is payday. Hiya, labor men, robim kati den.
2021 has been a year of transition for all of us. At the Battle of Homestead Foundation, they have discovered new ways to advance their mission of heritage, education, and social action. They expanded their educational outreach to include a weekly online tour of people's history locations through the Charlie's Monday Marker video series, as well as far-reaching discussion of social and economic trends with the podcast Essential Work, The Past, Present, and Future of Jobs. They presented 7 timely online public panels featuring nationally known authors and historians. Topics included workforce shifts from heavy industry to healthcare, the women's suffrage movement, uprooted immigrant neighborhoods, protest songs in today's civil action movements, the 1921 Battle of Blair Mountain, historical roots of today's social philanthropy, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania's world-famous city steps. They establish a professionally archived labor history collection, thousands of documents, photos, recordings, and remembrances of labor history spanning decades. They co-sponsored the Blair Mountain Centennial in West Virginia, honoring a long neglected part of U.S. history with a landmark Labor Day weekend of events. They built a new and more accessible website, which you should check out at battleofhomestead.org. They did all this with help, the essential support of all the individuals like you who enjoyed the programming, appreciate the hard work of the citizens, workers, educators, and historians that make it happen, and value their mission to preserve, interpret, and promote a people's history focused on the significance of the dramatic labor conflict at Homestead, Pennsylvania in 1892. In 2022, they'll present a new round of thought-provoking programming. Membership, along with special donations, is essential to their success. Annual membership is only $30, $20 for retirees or the underemployed, and just $10 for students. Join now at battleofhomestead.org. You can also choose to contribute at any of a number of special donor levels, and donations are tax deductible. Membership also provides multiple free admissions to a variety of historical museums and sites in the greater Pittsburgh area. Check out the details at battleofhomestead.org. As this singular year comes to a close, while we still may have much to be thankful for, we also all see the urgent necessity of doing more to share our progressive labor history to a wider audience and inspire a new generation of activists and organizers. Your membership and engagement ensures that the Battle of Homestead Foundation will continue to do just that. Show your support today at battleofhomestead.org. In solidarity, BHF thanks you and wishes you good health, positive spirits, and both peaceful and joyous days ahead.